who worked the scheme out using another simple imaginary computer, one that chugs back and forth along a paper tape divided into squares, making its behavior depend, aha, conditional branching, on whether it reads a 0 or a 1 on the square currently under its reading head. All the Turing machine can do is flip the bit, erasing 0, writing 1, or vice versa, or leave the bit alone, and then move left or right one tape square and go to its next instruction. I think you will agree that writing Turing machine programs to add and subtract and perform other functions using just the binary numbers 0 and 1 instead of all the natural numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., and moving just one square at a time is a more daunting exercise than our register machine exercises. But the point Turing made is exactly the same. A universal Turing machine is a device with a program A, hardwired if you like, that permits it to read its program B off its paper tape and then execute that program using whatever else is on the tape as data or input to program B. Hao Wang's register machine can execute any program that can be reduced to arithmetic and conditional branching, and so can Turing's Turing machine. Both machines have the wonderful power to take the number of any other program and execute it. Instead of building thousands of different computing machines, each hardware to execute a particular complicated task, we build a single, general-purpose, universal machine with program A installed, and then we can get it to do our bidding by feeding it programs, software, that create virtual machines. The universal Turing machine is a universal mimic, in other words. So is our less well-known universal register machine. So is your laptop. There is nothing your laptop can do that the universal register machine can't do, and vice versa. But don't hold your breath. Nobody said that all machines were equal in speed. We've already seen that our register machine is achingly slow at something as laborious as division, which it does by serial subtraction, for heaven's sake. Are there no ways to speed things up? Indeed, there are. In fact, the history of computers since Turing's day is precisely the history of ever faster ways of doing what the register machine does and nothing else. Secret 6. All the improvements in computers since Turing invented his imaginary paper tape machine are simply ways of making them faster. For instance, John von Neumann created the architecture for the first serious working computer, and in order to speed it up, he widened the window or reading head of Turing's machine from one bit at a time to many bits at a time. Many early computers read 8-bit words or 16-bit words or even 12-bit words. Today, 32-bit words are widely used. This is still a bottleneck, the von Neumann bottleneck, but it is 32 times wider than the Turing machine bottleneck. Simplifying somewhat, we can say that each word is copied from memory one at a time into a special register, the instruction register, where it is read and executed. A word typically has two parts, the operation code. For example, add, multiply, move, compare, jump if zero, and an address, which tells the computer which register to go to for the contents to be operated on. So, 10101110, 11101010101 might tell the computer to perform operation 10101110 on the contents of register 11010101010101, putting the answer always in a special register called the accumulator. The big difference between the register machine and a von Neumann machine is that the register machine can operate on any register, INC and DEB only, of course, while a von Neumann machine does all the arithmetic work in the accumulator and simply copies and moves, or stores, contents to the registers that make up the memory. It pays for all this extra moving and copying by being able to perform many different fundamental operations, each hardwired. That is, there is a special electronic circuit for add, and another for subtract, and yet another for jump if zero, and so forth. The operation code is rather like an area code in the telephone system or a zip code in the mail. It sends whatever it is working on to the right place for execution. This is how software meets hardware. How many primitive operations are there in real computers these days? There can be hundreds or thousands, or in a return to the good old days, a computer can be a RISC, reduced instruction set computer, which gets by with a few dozen primitive operations, but makes up for it in the blinding speed with which they are executed. If INC and DEB instructions could be carried out a million times faster than a hardwired ADD operation, it would pay to compose ADD by using INC and DEB as we did earlier, and for all additions, with less than a million steps, we'd come out ahead. How many registers are there in real computers these days? Millions or even billions. But they're each finite, so that really large numbers have to be spread out over large numbers of registers. A byte is 8 bits. If you have 64 megabytes of RAM, random access memory, on your computer, you have 16 million 32-bit registers, or the equivalent. We saw that numbers in registers can stand for things other than positive integers. Real numbers, like pi or the square root of 2 or 1/3, are stored using a system of floating-point representations, which breaks the number into two parts, the base and the exponent, as in scientific notation, 1.495 times 10 to the 41st, which permits computer arithmetic to handle, approximations of, numbers other than the natural numbers. Floating-point operations are just arithmetical operations, particularly multiplications and divisions, using these floating-point numbers as values. And the fastest supercomputer you could buy 20 years ago, when I wrote the first version of this chapter, could perform over 4 megaflops, over 4 million floating-point operations per second. If that isn't fast enough for you, it helps to yoke together many such machines in parallel, so they are all working at the same time, not serially, waiting in a queue for results to work on. There is nothing that such a parallel machine can do that a purely serial machine cannot do slower. In fact, most of the parallel machines that have been actively studied in the last 20 years have been virtual machines simulated on standard, non-parallel, von Neumann machines. Special-purpose parallel hardware has been developed, and computer designers are busily exploring the costs and benefits of widening the von Neumann bottleneck and speeding up the traffic through it in all sorts of ways, with coprocessors, cache memories, and various other approaches. Today, Japan's Fujitsu K computer can operate at 10.51 petaflops, which is over 10,000 trillion floating-point operations per second. That might be almost fast enough to simulate the computational activity of your brain in real time. Your brain is a parallel processor par excellence, with something in the neighborhood of 100 billion neurons, each quite a complicated little agent with an agenda. The optic nerve carrying visual information from your eye to your brain is, all by itself, several million channels, neurons, wide. But neurons operate much, much slower than computer circuits. A neuron can switch state and send a pulse, plausibly its version of INC or DEB, in a few milliseconds. Thousandths, not millionths or billionths of a second. Computers move bits around at near the speed of light, which is why making computers smaller is a key move in making them faster. It takes roughly a billionth of a second for light to travel a foot. So if you want to have two processes communicate faster than that, they have to be closer together than that. Secret 7. There are no more secrets. Perhaps the most wonderful feature of computers is that because they are built up by simple steps out of parts, operations, that are also dead simple, there is simply no room for them to have any secrets up their sleeve. No ectoplasm, no morphic resonances, no invisible force fields, no hitherto unknown physical laws, no wonder tissue. You know that if you succeed in getting a computer program to model some phenomenon, there are no causes at work in the model other than the causes that are composed of all the arithmetical operations. Now, what about quantum computing, which is all the rage these days? Aren't quantum computers capable of doing things that no ordinary computer can do? Yes and no. What they can do is solve many problems, compute many values simultaneously, thanks to quantum superposition, the strange and delicate property in which an unobserved entity can be in all possible states at once, until observation brings about collapse of the wave packet. Consult your favorite popular physics book or website for more on this. Basically, a quantum computer is just the latest, very impressive, innovation in speed, a quantum leap, one might say, in processing speed. A touring machine chugging along on his paper tape or register machine running around incrementing and decrementing single registers has a very strict limit on what it can do in practically small chunks of time, minutes or hours or days. A supercomputer like the Fujitsu K computer can do all the same things trillions of times faster, but that is still not fast enough to solve some problems, especially in cryptography. That is where the speed bonus of quantum computers could pay off, if people can solve the ferociously difficult engineering problems encountered in trying to make a stable, practical quantum computer. It may not be possible, in which case we may have to settle for mere quadrillions of flops. 25. Virtual machines. Real machines are made of moving material parts and are typically named for the jobs they are designed to do. Lawnmowers, can openers, and coffee grinders each come in a variety of designs, sometimes operating on different physical principles, but they have in common that the machines with the same name do the same job at some level of description. Maybe some do it better, but it all depends on what the user wants. A homeowner may prefer a slow lawnmower that is quiet. The owner of a cafe may prefer a coffee grinder that adjusts more accurately for the size of the grind at the cost of being harder to operate. Some machines are versatile. By plugging in a different attachment, you can turn a drill into a saw or a sander. Computers are like that, only instead of having a dozen different things they can be made to do, they can do gazillions of different things. And instead of having to plug in a different attachment for each task, you open a different program, a very long string of zeros and ones, which changes all the necessary internal switches to just the right settings to accomplish the job. Each of these different systems of settings is a different machine, a different virtual machine, a machine made of instructions, not gears and bearings, wires and pulleys. In computers, instructions can take the place of gears and pulleys because instead of processing bread dough or paper pulp or steel billets, computers process information, and information can always be translated into binary code, 0 and 1, the only code the computer can or needs to read. Those zeros and ones are shunted by the trillions through the circuits printed on the silicon chips, temporarily opening and closing gates, moving the streams of information to one circuit or another, thereby controlling what happens to it. The hardware's millions of tiny places that can be in either state 0 or state 1 are the only moving parts of the machine, and which machine a computer is at any moment depends on the settings of thousands or millions of little elements. A virtual machine is what you get when you impose a particular pattern of instructions, more literally dispositions, on a real machine that has lots of plasticity, interacting parts that can be in many different states. Since a virtual machine does informational work, it can do the same job as a computer whose moving parts are state changes in hardware by making all those state changes in representations of those moving parts. You can do long division with a pencil on a piece of paper, or if you're really good at long division, you can do it in your head by just representing, imagining, the marks on an imaginary page or blackboard. The yield is just as good either way, since it's information, an answer. Imagining making a ham sandwich, in contrast, is a poor substitute for making a ham sandwich if you're hungry. So good are computers at doing informational work in their heads, by representing the machine that does the work, that it can be next to impossible to tell whether the machine you are using and interacting with is a dedicated, hardwired, special-purpose information processing machine or a virtual machine running on a general-purpose chip. For instance, most, if not all, of the tiny, cheap computer chips that are now embedded in elevators and air conditioners, your car, your refrigerator, and the remote control for your television set are actually general-purpose computers, capable of executing versions of all the programs you run on your laptop, but doomed to spend their entire lives executing a single, relatively simple program. The ignition control program, the defrosting cycle, etc., burned into a ROM that freezes all their magnificent competence into a single trick or two. This is cheaper than making special-purpose chips designed to do only these simple tasks. The concept of a virtual machine is one of the most useful imagination stretchers to come out of computer science, and having proved its worth in that domain, it is ripe for importing to other areas. I am using the term in a somewhat extended sense, and will explain why in due course. So it is worth knowing what the original, and some say proper, meaning of the term is. Computer scientists Gerald Popek and Robert Goldberg, 1974, introduced the term. In its original use, it meant an efficient, isolated duplicate of a real machine. A duplicate made out of instructions. A real machine, call it A, is actual hardware made of silicon chips and wires and so forth. And a virtual machine is a computer program running on some other different real machine, B, that perfectly imitates the A hardware. It may run a bit slower because it has to compose all of A's most basic operations out of the basic operations available on its own hardware, B, but it runs all the same programs. If you have a program that was written to run on the A hardware, it should run without a hitch on the B hardware as well when the B hardware is running the virtual machine imitation of A. This is a remarkably useful trick, and not just because of the apparent thrift it suggests. Say you don't have a Mac, but have all this valuable software lying around that only runs on Macs. Well then, write a virtual machine, VM, imitation of a Mac that runs on your PC, and then your PC can run all the Mac software whenever it runs the Mac VM. Your PC will pretend it's a Mac, and the software will be none the wiser. Think of someone who has broken his arm and has it in a plaster cast. The cast severely restricts the movement of his arm, and its weight and shape also call for adjustments in the rest of his bodily movements. Now think of a mime, Marcel Marceau, say, imitating someone with a plaster cast on his arm. If the mime does the trick well, his bodily motions will be restricted in exactly the same ways. He has a virtual cast on his arm, and it will be almost visible. A PC imitating a Mac by running a Mac VM should be indistinguishable to the software running on it and to the outside observer from an actual Mac. Reality reverses my example more or less. Although people have developed Mac VMs that run on PCs, to my knowledge, these are more stunts than serious usable software. Macs, on the other hand, do have a reliable, user-friendly VM that runs the PC operating system, Windows, allowing Mac owners to run any PC Windows software they like. Most programs these days are not written to run on particular hardware, they are written to run on particular operating systems that in turn run on various hardwares. That's one reason for extending the concept of a virtual machine to include virtual imitations of operating systems. An operating system is itself a sort of virtual machine, allowing slightly different hardwares to run the same programs. But an operating system is only software. It does not imitate any actual hardware, but creates, by stipulation in effect, an imaginary machine that obeys certain rules, accepts certain inputs, and so forth. Another reason for extending the concept is that one of the most popular and ubiquitous virtual machines today is the Java Virtual Machine, or JVM, which, like an operating system, is not an imitation of any actual hardware machine, but rather exists only as a software machine. Java is the invention that is most responsible for giving the Internet its versatility. It lets you download little programs, Java applets, from websites that permit you to solve crossword puzzles, play Sudoku, explore maps and large photos, participate in adventure games with other players halfway around the world, and do a lot of serious computing, too. A website designer can write programs in the Java programming language without having to know whether the computers of the users who go to that website will be Macs or PCs, or Linux machines, because a Java applet always runs on a JVM specifically designed to run on either a Mac or a PC or a Linux machine. The appropriate JVM is automatically downloaded to your computer and installed in a few seconds, and then the Java applet runs on the JVM like magic. You may have noticed Java updates being downloaded to your computer, or you may not have noticed. Ideally, you can forget about which JVM is installed on your computer and just expect that any website you go to either will have Java applets that already run on your JVM or will install the appropriate Java update then and there so it will run. In my extended sense of the term, then, almost any computer program can be considered a virtual machine since it is software, a systematic list of instructions that, when it runs, turns a general-purpose computer into a special-purpose machine that could have been designed and wired up as hardware. One of Alan Turing's most brilliant contributions to science, indeed to human civilization since mid-20th century, is the idea of a universal computer, what we call today a universal Turing machine, which can be turned into any other clearly designed computer simply by installing and running a program on it. In case you decided to skip it, this is explained in detail in Chapter 24. You don't have to build all the different imaginable hardware computers. One hardware computer is all you ever need. Software will do all the rest. Ever since Turing's time, we've had the remarkable idea that you can take some complicated hunk of stuff, hardware, with lots of plasticity, adjustable memory, boxes or registers, and put a set of instructions in those memory boxes, which, when executed, will turn your hunk of stuff into whatever computer you can clearly imagine. A Turing machine, or a laptop, executes one instruction at a time and moves to the next instruction. But we can generalize the idea to parallel computers that can execute many millions of instructions at one time. A register is any place in the hardware that can hold itself in one state or another, like the zero state and the one state of the bits in your computer, but not necessarily restricted to two different states until something tells it to change its state. Any system of registers that can perform certain elementary operations on the basis of those states, such as changing a register from one state to another, or using the state of a register to determine what operation to do next, can have its register set in such a way as to compute a function or run a program. So any such hardware can run a virtual machine designed to exploit these basic steps. And a trick that can be done once can be done two or three or more times, implementing virtual machines in virtual machines in virtual machines in hardware. Consider a chess-playing program written in Common Lisp, a high-level computer language running on Windows 7, an operating system running on a PC. This is a PC pretending to be a Windows machine, pretending to be a Lisp machine, pretending to be a chess-playing machine. If we look at the details of the program at the highest level, they will be more or less comprehensible to a computer-savvy, chess-savvy observer. Aha! This subroutine generates all the legal responses to moving the bishop and then calls the evaluation subroutine, which... In contrast, looking at the actual machine code of the same program, the strings of zeros and ones that are fed into the hardware instruction register, is a good way to go crazy or blind, so we wisely focus our attention on the higher levels. At each level, we can see the woods in spite of all the trees, because the lower-level details are conveniently invisible. The parallel between the cascade of virtual machines on a computer and the cascade of homunculi and homuncular functionalism about the mind is no mere coincidence. It is the spectacular success of virtual machines in helping us create and comprehend material implementations of hitherto mind-boggling tasks, making airline reservations, playing chess, predicting the weather, taking dictation, etc., that inspires the hope that we can pull off a similar, only similar, stunt when we reverse engineer the brain. Perhaps then, the similarities between human brains whose owners speak French, in spite of all the anatomical differences observable, are best described at the virtual machine level. All of the French speakers have one version or another of the FVM, the French virtual machine, a system made of interlocking dispositions or microhabits stored somehow in the brain's billions of registers. Brains of English speakers will be distinguished by a similar system of reliable patterns, the EVM. If you say to a French speaker, "Donnez-moi le sel, s'il vous plaît," the FVM will reliably control the same behavior you elicit from an English speaker by feeding the EVM in her brain the input, "Please pass me the salt." Now, how do we build an FVM or EVM that will run in a brain? We don't yet know how to describe such different levels in the activities of brains of people playing chess or speaking French. No doubt there will be nothing like the precise mappings that have enabled computer programmers to design their inventions at the highest levels with full confidence that a running program will emerge from the compiler. A program that takes the high-level instructions and translates them into code that can run on the hardware. But we do now have an important proof of concept. We know at least one way to make sense of the high-level competences of a machine with trillions of moving parts, without invoking any wonder tissue. 26. Algorithms. In Darwin's Dangerous Idea, 1995A, I introduced this way of seeing what Darwin's great idea comes to. Life on Earth has been generated over billions of years in a single branching tree, the tree of life, by one algorithmic process or another. So what exactly is an algorithm? There are actually several competing senses of the term, and mine is perhaps the most commodious. What follows is drawn, with revisions, from my book. Darwin discovered the power of an algorithm. An algorithm is a certain sort of formal process that can be counted on, logically, to yield a certain sort of result whenever it is run or instantiated. Algorithms are not new, and they were not new in Darwin's day. Many familiar arithmetic procedures, such as performing long division and balancing your checkbook, are algorithms, and so are the decision procedures for playing perfect tic-tac-toe and for putting a list of words into alphabetical order. What is relatively new, and permits us valuable hindsight on Darwin's discovery, is the theoretical reflection by mathematicians and logicians on the nature and power of algorithms in general, a 20th century development that led to the birth of the computer, which in turn has led to a much deeper and more lively understanding of the powers of algorithms in general. The term algorithm descends via Latin, algorismi, to early English, algorism, and mistakenly therefrom, algorithm, from the name of a Persian mathematician, Musa al-Khwarizmi, whose book on arithmetical procedures written in the 9th century was translated into Latin in the 11th century by either Adelard of Bath or Robert of Chester. The idea that an algorithm is a foolproof and somehow mechanical procedure has been present for centuries, but it was the pioneering work of Alan Turing, Kurt Gödel, and Alonzo Church in the 1930s that more or less fixed our current understanding of the term. Three key features of algorithms will be important to us, and each is somewhat difficult to define. 1. Substrate neutrality. The procedure for long division works equally well with pencil or pen, paper or parchment, neon lights or skywriting, using any symbol system you like. The power of the procedure is due to its logical structure, not the causal powers of the materials used in the instantiation, just so long as those causal powers permit the prescribed steps to be followed exactly. 2. Underlying mindlessness. Although the overall design of the procedure may be brilliant or yield brilliant results, each constituent step and the transition between steps is utterly simple. How simple? Simple enough for a dutiful idiot or for a straightforward mechanical device to perform. The standard textbook analogy notes that algorithms are recipes of sorts, designed to be followed by novice cooks. A recipe book written for great chefs might include the phrase, "Poach the fish in a suitable wine until almost done." But an algorithm for the same process might begin, "Choose a white wine that says dry on the label. Take a corkscrew and open the bottle. Pour an inch of wine in the bottom of a pan. Turn the burner under the pan on high," and so on. A tedious breakdown of the process into dead simple steps, requiring no wise decisions or delicate judgments or intuitions on the part of the recipe reader. 3. Guaranteed results. Whatever it is that an algorithm does, it always does it, if it is executed without misstep. An algorithm is a foolproof recipe. It is easy to see how these features made the computer possible. Every computer program is an algorithm, ultimately composed of simple steps that can be executed with stupendous reliability by one simple mechanism or another. Electronic circuits are the usual choice, but the power of computers owes nothing, save speed, to the causal peculiarities of electrons darting about on silicon chips. The very same algorithms can be performed even faster by devices shunting photons in glass fibers, or much, much slower by teams of people using paper and pencil. What Darwin discovered was not really one algorithm, but rather a large class of related algorithms that he had no clear way to distinguish. 27. Automating the elevator. Before leaving our interlude about computers, I want to introduce one more group of useful ideas about source code, comments, and object code, which have an important application in our quest to understand how meaning could reside in brains. It is often wise to study a dead simple example in some detail to get a secure grip on our concepts before tackling a mind-buster. In the field of artificial intelligence, these are nicely known as toy problems. First, you solve the toy problem before tackling the gnarly great real-world problem. So this is a story made up, for simplicity's sake, but otherwise realistic, about how human elevator operators got replaced by computer chips. In my youth, there were elevator operators, people whose job was to go up and down in an elevator all day, stopping at the right floors to take on and let off passengers. In the early days, they manipulated a curious handle that could be swung clockwise or counterclockwise to make the elevator go up or down, and they needed skill to stop the elevator at just the right height. People often had to step up or down an inch or two upon entering and leaving, and operators always warned people about this. They had lots of rules about what to say when and which floors to go to first, and how to open the doors and so forth. Their training consisted in memorizing the rules and then practicing, following the rules until it became second nature. The rules themselves had been hammered out over the years in a design process that made a host of slight revisions and improvements. Let's suppose that this process had more or less settled down, leaving an ideal rulebook as its product. It worked wonderfully. Anybody who followed the rules exactly was an excellent elevator operator. Now imagine what happened when it became possible for a simple computer program to take over all the control tasks of the operator. In fact, this happened gradually, with various automatic mechanical devices being introduced to take the more skilled tasks away from the operator. But we'll imagine that elevators went from human operators to completely computer-controlled systems in one leap. The elevator manufacturer, let's suppose, calls in a team of software engineers, programmers, and hands them the rulebook that the human elevator operators have been following. This is a specification of the performance we want. Make a computer program that follows all the rules in this book, as well as the best human operators, and we'll be satisfied. As the programmers go through the rulebook, they make a list of all the actions that have to be taken and the conditions under which they are prescribed or forbidden. In the process, they can clean up some of the untidiness in the rulebook. For instance, if they build in sensors to ensure that the elevator always stops at exactly the right level, they can eliminate the loop that requires the operator to say, "Please step up" or "Please step down." But they might leave intact a simple recorded voice saying, "Nth floor, watch your step." Then they write out a sketch of the program in what is often called pseudocode, a sort of mongrel language that is halfway between everyday human language and the more demanding system of source code. A line of pseudocode might look something like this. If call floor is greater than current floor, then ascend until call floor equals current floor and stop. Open door. Wait. Once the plan is clear in pseudocode and seems to be what is wanted, the pseudocode can be translated into source code, which is a much more rigorous and structured system of operations, including definitions of terms, variables, subroutines, and so forth. Human beings can still quite readily decipher source code. After all, they write it, and hence the rules and terms of the rulebook are still quite explicitly represented there, if you know how to look for them. This is made easier by two features. First, the names for the variables and operations are usually chosen to wear their intended meaning on their sleeves. Call floor, wait some, tell floor, etc. Second, as we saw in Chapter 24, programmers can add comments to their source code, parenthetical explanations that tell other human readers of the source code what the programmer had in mind and what the various parts are supposed to do. When you write a program, it is wise to add comments for yourself as you go, since you may easily forget what you thought the line of code was doing. When you go back to correct programming errors, these comments are very useful. Source code has to be very carefully composed according to a strict syntax, with every element in the right place and all the punctuation in the right order, since it has to be fed to a compiler program, which takes the source code and translates it into the sequences of fundamental operations, in object code that the actual machine or virtual machine can execute. A compiler can't be asked to guess what a programmer means by a line of source code. The source code must tell the compiler exactly what operations to perform. But the compiler program may have lots of different ways of performing those tasks and will be able to figure out an efficient way under the circumstances. Some compilers are better than others. If you feed the same program, written in source code, into two different compilers, the object code that one compiler produces may run significantly faster than the other object code, for instance. Imagine you've written a chess program, and you feed its source code to two different compilers, then play the two compiled versions against each other on the same computer. Even though the two versions think all the same thoughts in the same order, they have to, they have exactly the same source code, one may always beat the other simply because it thinks those thoughts faster, using fewer basic machine cycles, and hence can look farther ahead during the time available. Back to our elevator. Once the compiler has compiled the object code, it can be executed. It's an executable file and usually has the suffix .exe in its name, by the virtual machine. It may need rounds of debugging, back to the source code, adjust it, then recompile, etc., but eventually it's a finished product. It can be burned into ROM on a tiny chip that contains a universal machine and any number of virtual machines on top of it and installed in the elevator. Installing it involves hooking up the inputs from transducers, such as the signals from the buttons and from the scale in the floor that measures the combined weight of the passengers and from other parts, and hooking up the outputs to effectors, running the motors that open and close the door and raise and lower the car, and updating the displays or playing the recordings. Ta-da! A machine has replaced one actual human being, not a figurative homunculus. And the machine follows the same rules as the human operator. Does it really? Really? Okay, it doesn't. It sorta follows the same rules. This is a nice intermediate case between a human being who memorizes and hence literally represents in her mind and consults the rules that dictate her behavior, and the planet, whose orbits are elegantly described by equations that the planets obey. We human beings also often occupy an intermediate level when we have internalized or routinized through practice a set of explicit rules that we may then discard or even forget. I before E except after C, or when it sounds like A as in neighbor and way. And it is also possible to sorta follow rules that have still not been explicit in debugged form. The rules of English grammar, for instance, which continue to challenge linguists. Put in terms of this example, linguists today are still thrashing around trying to write the rulebook for speaking good English, while every 10-year-old native English speaker has somehow installed and debugged a pretty good version of the object code for the EVM. Notice, before we leave this example, that the comments inserted in the source code to help the program designers keep track of the purposes of all the interlocking software parts have no counterpart in the design process that creates all the hardware, firmware, and software that characterize our brains. When natural selection installs various functional structures in our brains, this is like uncommented code. It's there for a reason, but the reason is not represented in the structure by any labeling or explanation, which the brain couldn't understand anyway. This will be discussed in more detail in Chapter 40. There are also uncommented, unannounced reasons for the adjustments that occur during development and learning. We, like the linguists, are still struggling to reverse engineer all these rules and procedures. This task is even harder than reverse engineering object code for the purpose of recovering source code, minus the comments, but it can be done in principle. Summary. For hundreds of years, we've had plenty of evidence that the brain is somehow the seat of the soul. But until the middle of the 20th century, it was all but unimaginable how this could possibly be true. The purpose of recovering source code, minus the comments, but it can be done in principle. Summary. For hundreds of years, we've had plenty of evidence that the brain is somehow the seat of the soul. But until the middle of the 20th century, it was all but unimaginable how this could possibly be true. The brain could be seen to be composed of lots of different, curiously shaped organs. in left and right pairs, given vivid names by early anatomists: the hippocampus, seahorse; the amygdala, almond; the wrinkly cortex, bark. But what on earth did these parts do? They didn't digest food or purify the blood, did they? Was the brain just an organ for cooling the blood? A sort of radiator, as Aristotle thought? The parts were connected by nerve fibers, so perhaps they communicated with each other somehow. Descartes suggested that some nerve fibers were like bell pull wires. When you tugged at one end, something happened at the other end. But what exactly? A bell ringing wouldn't seem to get you any closer to understanding the brain as the mind, and nobody had any better ideas. Then along came Turing, building on a tradition that went back to Babbage and Pascal and Leibniz and others, with the suggestion that a brain could be composed of simple parts that were ultimately just mechanical, like a mousetrap, a ringing bell, a lock and key, a synapse. But if these parts were organized to interact together in clever ways, they might actually be able to do something intelligent on their own, without human intervention and without any ghosts in the machine to guide them along. They might compute. Before Turing hit on his idea, computer was a job title. Industry and government hired thousands of people to be computers, calculating tables for use in business, navigation, gunnery, and banking, for instance. Maybe, he surmised, the brain is itself like a human computer. Maybe it processes information by slavishly following huge lists of very simple instructions, like ink and deb. Once the early theorists of cognitive science, Alan Turing and John von Neumann, the creator of cybernetics, Norbert Wiener, and the creator of information theory, Claude Shannon, as well as many others, articulated the idea, it could even seem obviously right. How could we not have seen it all along? Brains must take in information from the sense organs and process it by somehow computing with it until they have extracted the valuable ore of meaning, which by further computing, they could then categorize and store for future use in guiding the behavior of the body, which provided the brain with its energy and protective home. The key innovation in Turing's vision was that it eliminated the awkward element that was all too evident in earlier imaginings of information processing, junctures that required a clerk or translator or librarian, that required, in short, some kind of understander to appreciate the import of the signals. Turing saw that in one sense this was inescapable. Intelligent processes would always require choosing one course or another on the basis of the discrimination of some difference in the signal. But he could reduce this understanding to the barest minimum, conditional branching, the mindless process by which a device decides, sorta decides, to go left rather than right, because it senses, sorta senses, 1 rather than 0, A rather than B, X rather than Y. That, and arithmetic, were all you needed. You could then build up devices of any level of discernment by piling virtual machines on top of virtual machines on top of virtual machines, to put it anachronistically. This vision has been tempting for more than 50 years, but the details, as we've already begun to see, are not falling into place easily. If brains are computers, they aren't much like the computers we use every day. We need to remind ourselves of the fundamental features of computers so that we can consider more biologically realistic alternatives to the business-like architectures that are featured in our stereotypes. The point of this interlude has been to clarify and add just enough detail to that vision so that you can use it as a thinking tool, an imagination prosthesis to help you understand the issues we are now going to address. First, a bit more on how meanings might reside in brains and other machines, and then how such clever architectures could get designed by evolution without assistance from any master programmer or intelligent designer. You will then be in a good position to use the thinking tools you have acquired to think effectively about consciousness and free will, the two most treacherous topics I know. 5. More tools about meaning. 28. A thing about redheads. We have already seen some problems with the otherwise tempting idea that all the information we carry around in our brains, our beliefs, perceptions, memories, policies, and so on, is broken into sentence-like pieces that are filed away and ready to be awakened. brain writing cannot just install a false belief, and people can share a belief about that murder in London, for instance, without apparently having to share a formula in Brainish. But what else could store information in the brain? We human beings can learn things piecemeal, so there must be some way of adding independent facts roughly one at a time. Economists and others like to point out that you cannot do just one thing. Doing one thing always has consequences. Similarly, the idea that you can learn just one thing is dubious. But to a first approximation, you can. You earlier learned in this audiobook that there is a mammal called a poodoo. Unless you pause to check on this, you probably can't affirm anything else about poodoos, aside from the fact that they nurse their young, have backbones, and are relatively rare, since otherwise you surely would have heard of them. It's no mystery how you learned this. You heard a sentence and believed it. But can animals, or small children who do not yet have a language, learn a single fact? Like a fact expressed in a simple sentence, from some interesting bit of experience? The idea that knowledge or belief or learning has to be decomposable into sentence-sized gobbets is probably an illusion of anthropomorphism. We human beings encounter lots of declarative sentences, spoken and written, in the course of a day, and we thereby come to know all manner of facts and believe a smattering of falsehoods. Some we store in libraries and archives, and some we store only in our brains. We seldom memorize the actual sentences word for word, but when we salt away the gist of an encountered sentence, it must be, mustn't it, a matter of storing a sentence like something or other, a formula in Brainish. If this isn't so, what are the alternatives? Suppose Pat says that Mike has a thing about redheads. What Pat means, roughly, is that Mike has a stereotype of a redhead that is rather derogatory and influences Mike's expectations about, and interactions with, redheads. It's not just that Mike is prejudiced against redheads, but that he has a rather idiosyncratic and particular thing about redheads. And Pat might be right, more right than he knew. Could turn out that Mike does have a thing, not an idea or a thought or a belief or an image or any of the other traditional things that furnish our conscious experience, but a bit of subpersonal cognitive machinery in his brain that is about redheads in the sense that it systematically comes into play whenever the topic is redheads or a redhead, and adjust various parameters of Mike's cognitive machinery, making flattering hypotheses about redheads less likely to be entertained or confirmed, making relatively aggressive behavior vis-a-vis redheads closer to implementation than otherwise it would be, and so on. Such a thing about redheads could be very complex in its operation, or quite simple. The contribution of Mike's thing about redheads could be perfectly determinate, and also undeniably meaningful. And yet no expression of this meaning as a sentence believed true could be more than a mnemonic label for its role. That is, it might be impossible to characterize the role of this thing as a belief, weirdly specific or weirdly vague, that all redheads are F, where we cash out F with whatever content seems to do the most justice to Mike's attitude. Mike certainly has an attitude about redheads, but it isn't any particular propositional attitude, to use the philosophical jargon. In other words, it defies categorization in the format, Mike believes that, for all X, if X is a redhead, then, no matter how deviously we pile on the exclusion clauses, qualifiers, probability operations, and other explicit adjusters of content. Philosophers and other theorists have often tried to reduce all cognitive states to information-bearing states. Call them beliefs and desires that can be expressed in such formulas. And while the tactic is a great way of providing a rough sketch of some person's psychology, it's the intentional stance in effect, the idea of making it ultra-precise is hopeless. We can say, if we like, that various beliefs are implicit in the system. What this means is that the system is, currently, designed to operate under the assumption that the world's redheads have such and such features. When computer programmers put a comment on the source code telling everyone that this system relies on a defined set of assumptions, They know enough not to devote labor trying to render the propositions precise, because they appreciate that these are mnemonic labels for us observers, not anything the computer has to sorta read and sorta understand. And even for us observers, the comments are not specifications of content that can be used the way a chemist uses formulae to describe molecules. Giving an intentional stance interpretation of some subpersonal brain structure is like putting a comment on a few lines of code. When done well, it provides an illuminating label, not a translation into English or other natural language of some formula in brainish that the brain is using in its information processing. By missing this trick, some philosophers have created fantasy worlds of internal sentence-manipulating machinery, where it is imagined to make all the difference whether the content of a particular brain event is expressed using a disjunctive predicate, I see a boy or girl, or with a predicate lacking logical structure, I see a child, for instance. What is the aim of this intuition pump? It is simply an attempt to suggest that the familiar refrain in support of the language of thought, what else could it be, might have a good answer that would take the wind out of the sails of those who find it obvious. I wish I could provide an ambitious, alternative computational architecture that triumphantly displayed a working alternative, but I can't. Nobody can yet, but then almost nobody is trying, since the conviction is still widespread that the language of thought is the only straw floating, as somebody put it many years ago. Bear in mind, however, that nobody in cognitive science has developed a working model of the language of thought either, or has even tried very hard. It's a very, very difficult problem. I would like to encourage an open mind on this score. 29. The Wandering Two-Bitser, Twin Earth, and the Giant Robot. It may seem that by mentioning Mike's thing about redheads and source code in the same paragraph, I am encouraging listeners to ignore a crack in the foundation, indeed a yawning chasm in the middle of my discussion of intentionality, the problem of original intentionality. John Searle, 1980, coined the term, and the sharp distinction he draws between original and derived intentionality is on the face of it intuitively satisfying and even deeply compelling. The doctrine of original intentionality is the claim that whereas some of our artifacts may have a kind of intentionality derived from us, our books and movies, our computers and signposts, for instance, we have original or intrinsic intentionality utterly underived. For example, the printed words on my pages are about philosophy only because we readers and writers of English have thoughts and beliefs about philosophy that we contrive to convey using trails of ink, which wouldn't be about anything at all without us word users. Our thoughts and beliefs, in contrast, mean what they mean independently of any ulterior users. They exhibit original intentionality and are the source ultimately of all the derived intentionality in many of our artifacts. These include not just words and sentences and books, but maps, movies, paintings, signs, symbols, diagrams, and other technical representations, and, importantly, computers. Both a shopping list on a scrap of paper and a shopping list on your iPhone are about groceries only in virtue of the use you make of these symbol structures, the interpretation you bestow on them in aid of your desire to buy groceries and your belief that the supermarket is the place to go, which are about groceries more directly and originally. Aristotle said that God is the unmoved mover, and this doctrine announces that we are the unmeant meaners. We can all agree with Searle that nothing has intrinsic intentionality just in virtue of its physical shape or other such properties. If by cosmic coincidence the shape F-R-E-E-B-E-E-R appeared in traces of different minerals in a cliff face on Mars, it would not, in itself, be an announcement about an alcoholic beverage, no matter how eager Earthling readers were to interpret it that way. The shape wouldn't be about anything, in spite of first appearances. If some complicated events and objects in the world are about other things, it must be that they derive their aboutness somehow from being in the service of representing, interpreting intentional systems whose states, beliefs, desires, brain states, already have intentionality somehow. The question then is whether anything has original intentionality. And at first blush, it might seem obvious that something has to have original intentionality, since derived intentionality has to be derived from something. And then the obvious candidates for things with original intentionality would be human minds. So not surprisingly, some very eminent philosophers who otherwise disagree sharply with Searle on many issues, for instance, Jerry Fodor and Saul Kripke, nevertheless agree with him about this. They, and the many who concur, think that human minds, or their mental states, have original intentionality and are radically unlike robot control systems in this regard. They are all flat-out mistaken. Yes, mistaken. I mean it. Given the undeniable appeal of the distinction between original and derived intentionality, any attempt to discredit it runs the risk of being subverted by misplaced charity. He can't seriously be saying that we're wrong about that. He must mean something else, some esoteric philosophical point he has unwisely dressed up in these preposterously provocative clothes. Probably the best way to convince people that I really do mean it is to trot out as vivid and clear a case of derived intentionality as I can find, and then show that the beloved contrast between that case and human minds as cases of original intentionality evaporates on closer examination. It's a tall order, but here goes. I will need three linked intuition pumps to accomplish the feat. 1. The Wandering Two-Bitzer. Consider a standard soft drink vending machine, designed and built in the United States and equipped with a transducer device for accepting and rejecting U.S. quarters. Let's call such a device a two-bitzer. Normally, when a quarter is inserted into a two-bitzer, the two-bitzer goes into a state, call it Q, which means, note the scare quotes, it sort of means, I perceive, accept a genuine U.S. quarter now. Such two-bitzers are quite clever and sophisticated, but hardly foolproof. They do make mistakes. That is, unmetaphorically, sometimes they go into state Q when a slug or other foreign object is inserted into them, and sometimes they reject perfectly legal quarters. They fail to go into state Q when they are supposed to go into state Q. No doubt there are detectable patterns in these cases of misperception, and no doubt at least some of the cases of misidentification could be predicted by someone with enough knowledge of the relevant laws of physics and the design parameters of the two-bitzer's transducing machinery. It could follow quite directly from various applications of physical laws that not only legal U.S. quarters, but also objects of some kind K trigger state Q, but objects of kind J